centralizētais eksāmens angļu valodā. Augstākais mācību satura apguves līmenis.
Hello. This is the listening part of your exam in English. It will consist of three tasks. You will hear the texts twice. Task 1. You have 1 minute to read the task.
So you've got a brand new book, and it's called Super Communicators, How to Unlock the Secret Language of Connection. I'm just imagining that if I'd written that book, I would feel tremendous pressure to be an amazing conversation partner, and I would hate to have that expectation always hang over me. Do you feel the pressure I'm describing?
Only in one context, which is that ever so often now, my wife, during a dinnertime conversation, when I've like monologued for the last 7 or 8 minutes, will say, you know, there's this book about communication that I think you could read that would really help you a lot. No, I think the answer is that I don't feel that, because one of the big insights from this book and from doing this reporting and this research is that we all have these instincts, many of them created by evolution, to help us figure out how to connect with other people. And so part of what I tried to do with the book is to explain how conversations work so that in some sense, people can stop thinking about having those conversations. They can let their natural instincts take over. Because the truth of the matter is, you are a great conversationalist. You've literally spent your entire life practicing being a conversationalist. And once we understand how conversations work, we can converse and connect with really anyone.
So this is essentially a how-to book, how to have great conversations. But it differs in one important way from most how-to books, which is that most authors of how-to books are really great at whatever their book is about. So Dale Carnegie was really good at winning friends and influencing people, I'm sure. And Tiger Woods and Jack Nicklaus, they write books about how to golf. But your motivation for researching and writing this book was that you felt like you were bad at communicating. You wanted to get better.
Absolutely. It's a how-to book, but it's also self-help. And by self-help, I mean help myself, right? So I had these two experiences. The first is that I was made this manager at the New York Times and was really good at everything that did not involve communication and was terrible at communication. And it totally caught me off guard. Like, I have an MBA. I've had bosses my entire life. And it was really driven home for me when I would come home and talk to my wife and I'd tell her, like, my bosses don't understand me and my colleagues don't appreciate me. And I'd start complaining. And she would have this really good practical advice. She would say, like, why don't you take your boss out to lunch so you guys can get to know each other a little bit better? But instead of being able to hear her, I would react as if I'd been attacked and be like, I don't understand why you're not supporting me. I want you to be outraged on my behalf. And she would be frustrated because she was trying to give me good advice. And it made me realize there's something going on with communication that I'm just not getting, because sometimes I can have great conversations and sometimes I can't, and I can't figure out what the difference is. And so that's why I got interested in this, was just trying to learn, what do we know about conversation?
So one of the most basic insights in the book, and it sounds totally obvious once you present it, but it's something that I personally was completely oblivious to for the first 40 plus years of my life, is that the person you're talking to can have various different goals from a conversation. You just alluded to it. You were talking to your wife and you wanted empathy. But for most of my life, I thought that the purpose of every meaningful conversation was to find a solution to a problem.
Yeah.
But I was so wrong. I learned along the way And I was reinforced by your book that there are all sorts of things people want out of conversations. And one of the most fundamental aspects of being able to talk to people is recognizing that and figuring out what the point is of any given conversation.
You have 1 minute now to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time.
So you've got a brand new book, and it's called Super Communicators, How to Unlock the Secret Language of Connection. I'm just imagining that if I'd written that book, I would feel tremendous pressure to be an amazing conversation partner, and I would hate to have that expectation always hang over me. Do you feel the pressure I'm describing?
Only in one context, which is that ever so often now, my wife, during a dinnertime conversation, when I've like monologued for the last 7 or 8 minutes, will say, you know, there's this book about communication that I think you could read that would really help you a lot. No, I think the answer is that I don't feel that, because one of the big insights from this book and from doing this reporting and this research is that we all have these instincts, many of them created by evolution, to help us figure out how to connect with other people. And so part of what I tried to do with the book is to explain how conversations work so that in some sense, people can stop thinking about having those conversations. They can let their natural instincts take over. Because the truth of the matter is, you are a great conversationalist. You've literally spent your entire life practicing being a conversationalist. And once we understand how conversations work, we can converse and connect with really anyone.
So this is essentially a how-to book, how to have great conversations. But it differs in one important way from most how-to books, which is that most authors of how-to books are really great at whatever their book is about. So Dale Carnegie was really good at winning friends and influencing people, I'm sure. And Tiger Woods and Jack Nicklaus, they write books about how to golf. But your motivation for researching and writing this book was that you felt like you were bad at communicating. You wanted to get better.
Absolutely. It's a how-to book, but it's also self-help. And by self-help, I mean help myself, right? So I had these two experiences. The first is that I was made this manager at the New York Times and was really good at everything that did not involve communication and was terrible at communication. And it totally caught me off guard. Like, I have an MBA. I've had bosses my entire life. And it was really driven home for me when I would come home and talk to my wife and I'd tell her, like, my bosses don't understand me and my colleagues don't appreciate me. And I'd start complaining. And she would have this really good practical advice. She would say, like, why don't you take your boss out to lunch so you guys can get to know each other a little bit better? But instead of being able to hear her, I would react as if I'd been attacked and be like, I don't understand why you're not supporting me. I want you to be outraged on my behalf. And she would be frustrated because she was trying to give me good advice. And it made me realize there's something going on with communication that I'm just not getting, because sometimes I can have great conversations and sometimes I can't, and I can't figure out what the difference is. And so that's why I got interested in this, was just trying to learn, what do we know about conversation?
So one of the most basic insights in the book, and it sounds totally obvious once you present it, but it's something that I personally was completely oblivious to for the first 40 plus years of my life, is that the person you're talking to can have various different goals from a conversation. You just alluded to it. You were talking to your wife and you wanted empathy. But for most of my life, I thought that the purpose of every meaningful conversation was to find a solution to a problem.
Yeah.
But I was so wrong. I learned along the way, and I was reinforced by your book, that there are all sorts of things people want out of conversations. And one of the most fundamental aspects of being able to talk to people is recognizing that and figuring out what the point is of any given conversation.
You have 1 minute now to finish the task. This is the end of task one. Go on to task two. You have 1 minute to read the task.
The concept of math has been around for a long time. You know that. 3,000 years ago, the Egyptians were using fractions. Geometry was used in ancient Greece. And negative numbers were invented in China around 200 BC. I've always found it fascinating that different cultures developed mathematics, and ultimately that knowledge was shared with the rest of the world. But you know what? There's an underlying question to all of this. If math is largely made up of abstract concepts, how do we know that it's real? I mean, what does real mean anyway? My next guest wrote a whole book grappling with this question, and she's here with us now. Dr. Eugenia Chang, mathematician and author of Is Math Real? How Simple Questions Lead Us to Mathematics' Deepest Truths. She's joining me now from Chicago. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back.
That's a weird question to ask. Is math real? Why do you even ask that question?
Well, I've heard so many other people ask it and feel flummoxed by it. And often they're asking it because they really doubt whether it's real. And it's a way of saying, well, I don't think it's real, so why do I need to study it? And I think what's really coming out is many people's frustration with being forced to learn things that seem pointless at school. And so it comes out in this frustrated question, well, is it even real?
Right. I mean, if math wasn't real, how could we be using it to explain our world, right? The laws of physics, the shape of the universe, how we get to the grocery store. So it must be real.
Well, I think that the other question you posed is really, really on the nose, which is, what does real mean anyway? And I think that the thing is that even if math isn't real, it can still help us with real things. And what I say at the end of the book, not to give it away the ending, spoiler alert, is that actually, maybe, as they say, that's a feature, not a bug. That the fact that it's made up is part of where its power comes from. And I think that it's a bit like fiction. I love reading fiction. I know that some people don't like reading fiction and they only want to read nonfiction. But I love reading fiction. And that's made up. But often it can give us really deep insight into the actual world and our actual lives. even though it was made up. And I think sometimes it's because it was made up, a great novelist or a great film writer or playwright can make up things that are particularly moving to us and relevant to us.
Well, I want to go to the phones because so many people already have called in with their math questions. Yeah, isn't it amazing?
Hi, Ira. So I have a senior in high school. She's taking a college algebra. I don't deign to understand it, so I can't help her. So we got her a tutor. And so just yesterday, she met with her tutor. And when I picked her up, she's like, Mom, why do I have to, you know, I'm never going to use these equations. I don't understand why math is so important. And in fact, she only has to take like 7 semesters to graduate high school. So she's like, technically, I don't have to take math next semester, but it looks good on, you know, when applying for college. So I'm asking, so Dr. Chang, are you saying that like math helps you think critically and argue better in other areas?
Thank you for your question. And I have great sympathy for your daughter and anyone else who feels frustrated by things that they don't think they're ever going to use later in life. And the thing is that if you're taking math in high school to fulfill a requirement, and then you're doing it because it's going to look good on paper in order to go to college or something, that can be really demoralizing. And the kind of math that you get trained to do in those situations really can feel like it is pointless. And honestly, when I look at it, I do agree sometimes that it really is. Because if it's being taught as just algorithms that you have to memorize to churn out the right answer during tests, I think that has very limited use. I would love it if math could be taught so much more as a way of thinking. So that, yes, it does help you think more clearly and critically through any situation. And so that it can help you understand other people's arguments, follow people's arguments, tell when somebody is trying to manipulate you, recognize when the media is biased, spot when there is fake news or when scientific reporting is being not showing what's really going on with the scientific research. All of those things are things I feel I am helped by my mathematical training so that I can get through the world in a much better way and also help other people to understand it better. So I feel every day that my mathematical training helps me with all of those things, even though it's not specifically any particular formula or mathematical method that I'm using.
You have 1 minute now to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time.
The concept of math has been around for a long time. You know that 3,000 years ago, the Egyptians were using fractions. Geometry was used in ancient Greece. And negative numbers were invented in China around 200 BC. I've always found it fascinating that different cultures developed mathematics. And ultimately, that knowledge was shared with the rest of the world. But you know what? There's an underlying question to all of this. If math is largely made up of abstract concepts, how do we know that it's real? I mean, what does real mean anyway? My next guest wrote a whole book grappling with this question, and she's here with us now. Dr. Eugenia Chang, mathematician and author of Is Math Real? How Simple Questions Lead Us to Mathematics' Deepest Truths. She's joining me now from Chicago. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back.
That's a weird question to ask. Is math real? Why do you even ask that question?
Well, I've heard so many other people ask it and feel flummoxed by it. And often they're asking it because they really doubt whether it's real. And it's a way of saying, well, I don't think it's real, so why do I need to study it? And I think what's really coming out is many people's frustration with being forced to learn things that seem pointless at school. And so it comes out in this frustrated question, well, is it even real?
Right. I mean, if math wasn't real, how could we be using it to explain our world, right? The laws of physics, the shape of the universe, how we get to the grocery store. So it must be real.
Well, I think that the other question you posed is really, really on the nose, which is, what does real mean anyway? And I think that the thing is that even if math isn't real, it can still help us with real things. And what I say at the end of the book, not to give it away the ending, spoiler alert, is that actually, maybe, as they say, that's a feature, not a bug. That the fact that it's made up is part of where its power comes from. And I think that it's a bit like fiction. I love reading fiction. I know that some people don't like reading fiction and they only want to read nonfiction. But I love reading fiction. And that's made up. But often it can give us really deep insight into the actual world and our actual lives, even though it was made up. And I think sometimes it's because it was made up, a great novelist or a great film writer or playwright can make up things that are particularly moving to us and relevant to us.
Well, I want to go to the phones because so many people already have called in with their math questions. Yeah, isn't it amazing?
Hi, Ira. So I have a senior in high school. She's taking a college algebra. I don't deign to understand it, so I can't help her. So we got her a tutor. And so just yesterday, she met with her tutor. And when I picked her up, she's like, Mom, why do I have to, you know, I'm never going to use these equations. I don't understand why math is so important. And in fact, she only has to take like 7 semesters to graduate high school. So she's like, technically, I don't have to take math next semester, but it looks good on, you know, when applying for college. So I'm asking, so Dr. Chang, are you saying that like math helps you think critically and argue better in other areas?
Thank you for your question. And I have great sympathy for your daughter and anyone else who feels frustrated by things that they don't think they're ever going to use later in life. And the thing is that if you're taking math in high school to fulfill a requirement, and then you're doing it because it's going to look good on paper in order to go to college or something, that can be really demoralizing. And the kind of math that you get trained to do in those situations really can feel like it is pointless. And honestly, when I look at it, I do agree sometimes that it really is. Because if it's the way, if it's being taught as just algorithms that you have to memorize to churn out the right answer during tests, I think that has very limited use. I would love it if math could be taught so much more as a way of thinking. So that, yes, it does help you think more clearly and critically through any situation. And so that it can help you understand other people's arguments, follow people's arguments, tell when somebody is trying to manipulate you, recognize when the media is biased, spot when there is fake news or when scientific reporting is being not showing what's really going on with the scientific research. All of those things are things I feel I am helped by my mathematical training so that I can get through the world in a much better way and also help other people to understand it better. So I feel every day that my mathematical training helps me with all of those things, even though it's not specifically any particular formula or mathematical method that I'm using.
You have 1 minute now to finish the task. This is the end of task two. Go on to task three. You have 1 minute to read the task.
According to various sources, about 5 billion of the world's 8 billion plus population regularly use some form of social media. Consequently, the societal impact of these media, and specifically the messages and the information that people convey through them, is huge. That, UCL's Laura Globig argues, is the problem with many social media platforms. Engineered to engage and promote information exchange, they don't reward users for the veracity of what they share. So she's come up with a way to recognise and reward users for the trustworthiness of what they're sharing.
It is true that these platforms tend to rely on metrics of engagement, so reward and punishment dynamics, to motivate people to post information online and also to react to posts. And that is very similar to any sort of reward mechanism you would see in the real world. So just like giving you money, your brain behaves the same way if you receive likes on social media. You process it in a similar manner.
And are there any particular groups who are more susceptible to this? Or is everyone potentially a sucker for it?
Everyone is susceptible to a certain extent. It is true that people who tend to not question information as much tend to fall victim more.
So what have you done here? And would it work for those people?
People are actually quite good at distinguishing true from false information. So it's not a lack of ability. In fact, existing research shows that lay people are just as good as professional fact checkers at telling apart true from false information. Instead, one reason for the spread of misinformation online is the lack of incentives on social media platforms to share true information and avoid sharing false information. People tend to choose actions that lead to rewards or positive feedback and avoid those that lead to punishment. And on social media platforms, these rewards and punishments come in the form of likes and dislikes. But the issue with these likes and dislikes is that they aren't representative of the accuracy of the information you're sharing. For example, you could like an obviously false post because you think it's amusing. So we now propose that the key to reducing the spread of misinformation online is not to tell people what's true and what's false, but instead to directly incentivize them to share more true relative to false information. And so we need an incentive structure where these social rewards and punishments are directly contingent on the accuracy of the information.
So what you're saying is instead of there being thumb up, thumb down, like, dislike, I could have I trust this, I don't trust this.
Exactly. So in this study, we do this by slightly altering the engagement options offered to users. So we're not taking away the like and the dislike button, but instead we added an option to react to posts using, just as you said, the trust and distrust buttons.
You can envisage why people would be incentivized to use that, because it's an additional badge of honor for them saying, I'm sharing this, but it's a bit iffy. And then if it turns out that it is a bit iffy, they can say, well, I told you so. So it does kind of play into the same reward system, but it's for the benefit of more clear communication.
Exactly. Here, there's no ambiguity in the use of the trust and distrust. So trust, by definition, is related to reliability. It's a firm belief in the truth and reliability of something. And so what we found in this study is that people would use these buttons to actually differentiate between true and false posts.
So what data have you got that suggest this will actually work?
What we did was we created simulated social media platforms. And in these platforms, users saw both true and false information. And then we added an option to react to posts using a trust and a distrust button, in addition to the usual like and dislike buttons. And so then what we found was that people used these buttons to differentiate true from false information more so than they used the like and dislike buttons. And as a result of that, to receive more trust rewards and fewer distrust punishments, other participants were then also more likely to share true information relative to false information. So what we saw was a large reduction in the amount of misinformation being spread.
You have 1 minute now to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time.
According to various sources, about 5 billion of the world's 8 billion plus population regularly use some form of social media. Consequently, the societal impact of these media, and specifically the messages and the information that people convey through them, is huge. That, UCL's Laura Globig argues, is the problem with many social media platforms. Engineered to engage and promote information exchange, they don't reward users for the veracity of what they share. So she's come up with a way to recognise and reward users for the trustworthiness of what they're sharing.
It is true that these platforms tend to rely on metrics of engagement, so reward and punishment dynamics, to motivate people to post information online and also to react to posts. And that is very similar to any sort of reward mechanism you would see in the real world. So just like giving you money, your brain behaves the same way if you receive likes on social media. You process it in a similar manner.
And are there any particular groups who are more susceptible to this? Or is everyone potentially a sucker for it?
Everyone is susceptible to a certain extent. It is true that people who tend to not question information as much tend to fall victim more.
So what have you done here? And would it work for those people?
People are actually quite good at distinguishing true from false information. So it's not a lack of ability. In fact, existing research shows that lay people are just as good as professional fact checkers at telling apart true from false information. Instead, one reason for the spread of misinformation online is the lack of incentives on social media platforms to share true information and avoid sharing false information. People tend to choose actions that lead to rewards or positive feedback and avoid those that lead to punishment. And on social media platforms, these rewards and punishments come in the form of likes and dislikes. But the issue with these likes and dislikes is that they aren't representative of the accuracy of the information you're sharing. For example, you could like an obviously false post because you think it's amusing. So we now propose that the key to reducing the spread of misinformation online is not to tell people what's true and what's false, but instead to directly incentivize them to share more true relative to false information. And so we need an incentive structure where these social rewards and punishments are directly contingent on the accuracy of the information.
So what you're saying is instead of there being thumb up, thumb down, like, dislike, I could have I trust this, I don't trust this.
Exactly. So in this study, we do this by slightly altering the engagement options. offer to users. So we're not taking away the like and the dislike button, but instead we added an option to react to posts using, just as you said, the trust and distrust buttons.
You can envisage why people would be incentivized to use that, because it's an additional badge of honor for them saying, I'm sharing this, but it's a bit iffy. And then if it turns out that it is a bit iffy, they can say, well, I told you so. So it does kind of play into the same reward system, but it's for the benefit of more clear communication.
Exactly. Here, there's no ambiguity in the use of the trust and distrust. So trust, by definition, is related to reliability. It's a firm belief in the truth and reliability of something. And so what we found in this study is that people would use these buttons to actually differentiate between true and false posts.
So what data have you got that suggests this will actually work?
What we did was we created simulated social media platforms. And in these platforms, users saw both true and false information. And then we added an option to react to posts using a trust and a distrust button, in addition to the usual like and dislike buttons. And so then what we found was that people use these buttons to differentiate true from false information more so than they use the like and dislike buttons. And as a result of that, to receive more trust rewards and fewer distrust punishments, other participants were then also more likely to share true information relative to false information. So what we saw was a large reduction in the amount of misinformation being spread.
You have 1 minute now to finish the task. This is the end of task 3 and the whole listening test.